Thank you. Thanks, everybody. I want to discuss the empty chair. It's not for Obama. It's not for Romney. It's also not for Kathleen Merrigan of the USDA, who could not be with us. It's for Andrew Sharpless, who I think is on the ground at Lubbock Airport and on his way got stranded last night in Dallas. So when he gets here, we're going to pop him into that chair. Let me introduce my panel sort of functionally as opposed to using their titles, because that's in your programs, I hope, I think. Andrew Sharpless, who's not here, he is the CEO of Oceana, which is a nonprofit focused on saving the oceans in order to save the world. Small task. Chris Funk, to my left, is a geographer with the U.S. Geological Survey. His project, Famine Early Warning System, does global climate forecasting to sort of get a heads up about looming problems like drought and food distress around the world, especially in places like Africa and the Middle East. Helene York is with Bon Appetit, which is not the magazine as I originally thought, but a large food management company. And she's a purchasing director, many things, but purchasing director. She works with restaurants inside companies like Google and eBay, and also inside museums all over the country, including the Getty in Los Angeles, the Art Institute of Chicago, and the Museum of Modern Art in Fort Worth, right here in Texas. And she educates her customers, her staff, and her supply chain about sustainable food practices. And Dick Ald, Dr. Ald, is the Rockwell Endowed Chair in Plant and Soil Science here at Texas Tech. He specializes in oil and oil seeds, and he's going to talk a little bit about what that means, and plant genetics. His research serves everyone from industrial agriculture to small farmers here in water-starved Texas. So welcome, everybody. I want to start by just going around, and, well, I've been introduced myself, but I should up front admit that I have a little bit of a bias on this issue. I really like to eat. So if anyone else has this bias, you know, you'll have to leave. I want to start by asking each panelist to just to talk about some of the big challenges. I'm sure we all know what some of them are. Climate change, obviously, is one, but there's some others. And let's just go around and identify some of the big things. I'll start with Chris. I think it's on.
Okay.
Yep. You're good.
Okay. I think that, first of all, in my day job, I'm basically a threat detector. You know, I work for the U.S. government and for the U.S. Agency for International Development and the USGS to help spot places where there might be famine emerging in the world. And, you know, originally most of our work focused on, and still does, on, you know, the Sahel in Africa, Eastern Africa, Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia. But what we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years is the emergence of more pockets of food insecurity appearing around the world. And it's a really growing and spreading problem. And, you know, the concerning thing is that, you know, what we see in places like Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia is, the, you know, kind of a triple threat that's produced by the interaction of population growth, drought, perhaps increasing drought. That's part of what my research has been looking at. And then also resource scarcity. And that formula for trouble is really playing out on a global scale. And, you know, you can think about the rise of population really associated with four problems. You know, so between now and 2040, the population is going to go up about 32% to something like 9.6 billion people. You know, and so there's an S-curve in population, and we're at the place where the population growth rates are coming down, but the absolute increase in population is still going up. And so we're going to add a lot of people in the next 20 or 30 years. And that population, you know, creates certain stresses on the system. First of all, more people means you need to have more food. And what's happened, you know, over the last 20 years actually is a good thing. We've seen a really massive increase in wealth in places like Asia, South America, and that's been really good in terms of poverty, in terms of education, in terms of the reduction in the need for food aid overall. But that's also, you know, a billion more people eating meat you know, and so that's really increasing the demand. And so that's one way that population growth is a problem. Another one is more people tend to need more space to live. And, you know, depending on what happens with global cropland, you know, we could either slide back to a food security situation that we were at in the 1960s, or we could remain a balance. And there's a handout over there that you can look at if you want to see that.
But not now.
But not now, after the talk at the corner.
Right.
And then, of course, more people means more greenhouse gases, and it also means more demand for things like gas and fertilizer. And then the next part of the problem, so it was drought, it's population growth, drought, and then scarcity. And the drought one is really concerning to me. And for years, I've been looking at the problem in Africa, specifically looking at how warming in the Western Pacific and the Indian Ocean is probably leading to more drought in places like Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia. And the disturbing thing that I've been looking at just recently, this is pretty new, it's not really established in the literature yet, but it really looks to me that, you know, when you get this warming in the Western Pacific, part of that creates dry air over Eastern Africa, but it also creates dry air over North America. And so there's a possibility that the string of droughts that we've seen in East Africa and in the United States are tied, and tied to global warming. So that's a big concern.
Very interesting. Lena, I want you to pick up on the more people eating more meat question and talk a little bit about what that means.
Sure. I could agree with everything you said, so I'm not going to repeat any of that. I'm in a really wonderful position in that I really support 500 chefs in 32 states that run restaurants that feed people every day, whether it's colleges or corporations or museums. They have a day-to-day need to bring high-quality, flavorful, environmentally responsible food to their guests every day. But I get to think about not only those issues, but also where are we going in the future. And I like to think about our food ecosystem and what is that. You know, if we're growing enough yields of specialty crops, but the fertilizer and the pesticide is running off and creating dead zones, that depletes our fish stocks or changes our ocean ecosystems, then that is problematic. If we are, having cow manure that's poisoning oyster beds, that's affecting our food ecosystem. Even in a pasture-raised system that is touted by every supplier. By the way, every supplier, whether they provide meat, cheese, vegetables, calls themselves now a sustainable food provider, right? A supplier, every single one of them. But if you look at it from the perspective of a food ecosystem, I would argue there may be no supplier that's now providing sustainable food, especially if we have greater impacts with population and climate variability and less water and other kind of storm systems, so forth and so on. I think most of you know that the livestock production is about half of the component of the food system's contribution to climate change. That's writ large globally. That's everything from land use changes to methane emissions and so forth. But it's us, you know, what can we do on a long-term basis and what can we do on a day-to-day basis? And they really come together when it comes to protein on the plate. And that is to find culinary applications to reduce how much meat is on the plate and what types of meat are on the plate. So we've really focused on culinary solutions, making food taste good, making it look good, smell good, the things that are the cues to consumers to say, aha, I want to eat this food, but making it so that they're actually eating less but still being satisfied, so that it's not like in the previous panel we were talking about an affront to personal values. If we're still serving meat, whether it's as a garnish, or with a rich mushrooms, so that the stew is very flavorful and has that meaty texture, but has a fraction of the meat that it used to have in it. We're not going to affront people's values, but we're still going to give them what they want, but going to radically reduce the profile of the food that we're serving.
Dick, I want you to pick up, of course, on the drought, because this is your business here. What has changed right here?
Very good. When Jay hears this, he'll probably charge me full to a registration for the conference, but I'm here to learn. This last year, I took over our freshman course, and I trained agronomists and horticulturists and animal scientists and ag engineers in agricultural production. And at my level, the agronomists and horticulturists that grow our crop plants are they going to be the foot soldiers that face these challenges in the next 50 years. And they need to understand the motivation and the science base they need to do it. And as I told Christy yesterday, I've still got a third of this class to teach, and I'm here to write that lesson plan today. So I'm here to do that. Here in West Texas, we had a once-in-30-year drought in 2012. Last year, we had a one-in-500-year drought. If we had been Indians, Pueblo-style Indians, living in the Rio Grande Valley, we wouldn't be living there anymore because the drought would have been a cultural-changing experience. And so production in the western two-thirds of our country, it's all about the water. If you take the Mississippi River and divide our country into a third and two-thirds, right down the Mississippi River, the third east of the Mississippi River gets two-thirds of the rain. And the two-thirds of the country west of the Mississippi gets one-third of the rain. Now, that doesn't seem very fair. So I'm actually here to learn from my colleagues and from you and our interaction. Thank you.
Wrong thing up to my mouth. Dick, tell me about the cantaloupe.
There's an area south of here about 170 miles away called the Pecos Valley, and it was once our garden. It was like the Imperial Valley is in California, and it's fed by the Pecos River. And we used to wait and wait to see the harvest come off, and we would go get us a Pecos cantaloupe. They were the sweetest, most wonderful cantaloupes in the whole world. That area was over a quarter million acres, and today 99% of that is abandoned due to salting out of the soil. The soil, the water table there has picked up salt. People argue about where it came from. But the Pecos River runs through some potash mines there, so some of it's indigenous. Some of it may have leaked from the oil field. But now we have an area there that is laser leveled, laid in concrete ditches, wells drilled down to the bottom, and it's abandoned and growing tumbleweeds. So it's really sad. So water and water quality continue to be critically important in the western United States.
I want to keep going with you because I want to start talking now about the consequences, predictable and unexpected, of these kinds of changes in these environmental pressures. And Dick, I want you to stay right here in the U.S. and talk a little bit about what changes are occurring with agriculture, with agriculture versus energy production, and so on, as things are changing.
Okay, I'm going to give a plug to my field trip that we're doing tomorrow. We've been in the drought business for the last 50 years. We have enough drought that we don't have to artificially set up a drought condition for that to occur. And so at 2:15, we're going to take a tour out to the plant stress laboratory. Jay Leno one time says, "I know what causes plant stress. That's a lawnmower." But out here in West Texas, it's not a lawnmower. Out here in West Texas, it's lack of moisture. And so we've been looking. Some of you went to the Bayer Labs, and I understand that was a special good treat. The next generation of GMOs is not going to be herbicide resistance and not going to be insecticide resistance, but it's going to be drought tolerance. It's going to be heat tolerance. And it's going to help stabilize plant growth through a very unpredictable climate. I told Christy yesterday when I'm out talking, if it's a conservative group of growers, I have to call what's happening to our environment climate change. And if I know there's a lot more liberal audience, perhaps more Democrats, I can say global warming. But the phenomena is the same regardless of how you call it. Our climate's becoming more unpredictable, and our climate's becoming drier.
Helene, talk a little bit about food shortages and how that's, what are some of the consequences with that?
Well, first I have to tell you that I got a communication from our purchasing procurement group just a few days ago that said very clearly that meat is going to become an indulgence item within a year. Now, you have to understand, if I had written that, people would just say, oh, that's just Helene. You know, she's been on this reduced meat kick for 5 years. But these are people who write major contracts with giant producers of, chicken and beef and pork and so forth, and they're actually predicting this. That shocked me. I really didn't think I was going to see the day when they made that comment. I think we are beginning to see, of course, a lot of our guests, as we like to call our customers, are college students. And even over the past 8 years, I have seen changes in their willingness to change, to adapt their own diets. They are accepting more variety, and I think that has a lot to do with a greater American acceptance of different cultural themes in their foods. And so they are used to variability, and they're gonna choose more variety. But there is also a lot of concern about taking their food away. You know, that much like what we talked about in the first panel talked about, there is this tension about you can't tell me what to eat. And so I do see, if you will, culture wars coming as a lot of our more familiar foods become more expensive. This is something, and a little less available. Certainly we have culture wars when we talk about small-scale farming versus GMOs. And there's no conversation happening right now. I see that as a big threat. There's no conversation happening where people of those different viewpoints are having rational discussions as to the value and the potential problems of any of those type of cropping systems. So I think the consequences are going to be borne out. Actually, there is a much greater interest in what's happening with the food system, what we eat, where it comes from. A lot of it is ideological, but that's really the first stage as I see it. And I think there's a lot more conversation to happen about what our true values are with food. And I think we have potential of moving in a direction that's a little faster than what we've seen over my lifetime.
Helene, talk a little bit, if you would, about what's changing in terms of diets around the world as developing countries become more first world countries.
Well, certainly one of the things that is disturbing from a global environmental perspective, and Chris alluded to this before, not from a poverty alleviation perspective, but when you've got more affluent communities having more money, they can choose to eat more meat and more high-trophic species of all varieties, especially seafood varieties, that it just takes that many more resources to feed the world. Look at the Peruvian anchoveta fishery, which is about 10% of the world's biomass of world wild capture fisheries. More than 90% of that goes to feed farmed animals, whether they're farmed seafood or farmed fish. Instead of feeding the Peruvian children, 56% of whom are malnourished, and who are mostly indigenous Peruvians, very accustomed to eating dried fish. I mean, it's not like, oh, you want me to eat something that I'm unfamiliar with. This is something that would be readily accepted, but is not available to them, because higher prices are being paid by the livestock and farm seafood, higher trophic seafood producers to buy that stuff. So I see a real concern globally that in some ways we're increasing the amount of high trophic species that we eat that is demanded around the world. And at the same time, we're losing some of the multi-trophic aquaculture that China has practiced for 1,000 years. That really is a model that potentially could fit in many places around the world.
Can you define hypertrophic?
So there's a great term called integrated multitrophic aquaculture. And I know I've just all put you to sleep by saying that. So let me tell you how I remembered it. Remember that song YMCA, right? So integrated multitrophic aquaculture. You'll never forget it, right? It means that you can have, like in China, carp and silkworms living off each other's byproducts in the same place. It means yellow perch and shrimp in the Midwest. It means seaweed and some salmon species. There are lots of experiments that are new. The Chinese example, of course, is very old. But what I fear is that while we need aquaculture, I don't think anyone really who knows much about fish denies that. We need responsible aquaculture. And that doesn't mean we're necessarily moving in that direction. But IMTA is, I think, an example of responsible aquaculture in most cases.
Chris, I'm going to come back to you in a second, but I want to introduce Andy Sharpless, CEO of Oceana. And have you caught your breath enough to start telling us the horrible problems that are looming around the ocean and seafood that we rely on? Great.
Hi, I'm sorry to be late. And I appreciate what a dangerous thing is for the moderator to hand over the portable mic, so I will be respectful. The main point I'd want to make, and I hope I'm not repeating stuff that you said this morning, is that if you want to feed the world, and as we all know, that's a big challenge already, and to 9 billion people makes it a bigger challenge, and the rise in middle class and the demand for livestock-based meat that the middle class of China and India and Brazil and so forth will have, you see a terrestrial agricultural system under enormous amount of stress. And you would, if you were logical, want the other 71% of the planet to be contributing as much food as possible. Right now, the oceans of the world provide 17% of all the animal protein eaten by human beings in the world. 17% comes from the oceans right now. They're kind of mismanaged right now. And the world wild fish catch has been in decline since the late 1980s. That picture ought to be turned around if you want to feed people. And you need to do aquaculture sensibly, as you just heard. We know how to turn that around. And a study last week in Science magazine by three scientists, Costello, Gaines, and Hilborn, estimate that on a global basis, fishery management could produce a 40% upside from where we are now on increased wild fish harvests. If you think about the alternative pressure on the natural systems of the land to feed all the animals, to produce all the cows, all the pigs, all the sheep that you'd need to produce to equal, you know, what is about 100 million metric tons of animal protein from the oceans a year, if you do it right, you see what an important role the oceans play in saving the planet. The forests that don't need to be cut down, the methane that doesn't get produced by additional livestock, the additional grain demand that pushes up basic grain prices, the demand for fresh water for irrigation, all that is, in essence, avoided by having a productive ocean.
Great. Chris, I want you to talk about the some of the more consequences that are a little bit less predictable, or maybe they're predictable now, in terms of things like the Arab Spring and other kinds of serious threats and consequences.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think I'll come back to this idea of rising prices and scarcity. And, the way that people like the FAO think about these things, if you've seen this number that there's a billion undernourished people in the world, well, the way they do that is they come up with this distribution of calories, right? And it's a function of how much food there is, but also what's the spread in terms of poverty. And then they draw a line and they say everybody under this line is undernourished. And what happens is prices go up, is that moves that line to the right, potentially by a lot. And so, You know, people in the United States spend about 7% of their income on food. Europe, 15. Places like Kenya, about 45%. And places, you know, in the marginal lands of Kenya, like in Moyale, which is at the corner of Ethiopia, Somalia, and Kenya, people pay 70%. So when the price of food doubles, they eat a lot less. And, you know, we've seen already in Eastern Africa outbreak of famine and severe food crises. But the, you know, international agencies are really worried about this in terms of global food stress is kind of what they call it, kind of like plant stress. And, you know, it's really hard to say that this causes the Arab Spring or causes anything, but it's certainly a big stressor that's really impacting a lot of people around the world.
And I want to go back to you, Andy, on this question as well. What do people eat around the world, and what does it cost?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, starting at the top, I mentioned 17% of the world's animal protein is marine fish. That's 7% of all protein is marine fish. And the breakdown between aquaculture and wild is about, if you look at marine aquaculture, it's about 80% wild and about 20% aquaculture. If you look at marine fish, if you look at all aquaculture where you're considering inland aquaculture, it's about 40%, 60%, 40% aquaculture, 60% wild. The biggest marine capture fishes in the world by tonnage, we already heard about number one, so it's a very sophisticated audience. I've never had the answer to this question ever given before I've spoken, but you all now know it. The biggest fish by weight in the world is a little fish, the anchovy. Caught off the coast of Peru this year, it's actually 12% of the world's fish catch by weight. One fish, Peruvian anchovy. Actually, if you think about the potential, therefore, for doing something good, you're encouraged because one country has within its EEZ the ability to manage an important fishery for the world. Number two in the world's wild fish catch standings is pollock, known to you as your McDonald's fish sandwich, or surimi probably. Pollock, big American fishery, very, very successful off of Alaska. Number three, herring. Number four, skipjack tuna. Number five, chub mackerel. Those are the top five wild fisheries. The top five aquaculture, who wants to guess the number one? Carp, farmed in enormous quantities in China. Number two is clams, three is oysters, four is shrimp, five is tilapia. So you will recognize those species. The ones, as we've already heard, that we ought to eat more of are the ones that are being fed to animals, especially anchovy.
Great. Helene, talk about who eats what and what it costs that we haven't heard already.
More specific.
Well, maybe you want to talk about meat.
Well, in the United States, believe it or not, we used to be a pork-eating nation primarily until 1950. Chicken, of course, now is the most prevalent protein that we eat. But chicken was almost not eaten at all in the United States until World War II. And the reason is there was meat rationing that the USDA was able to effect. And the reason is, you know, we can go against our values when it's for a big cause, like feeding the troops. And so meat was rationed, but not chicken, because chicken was deemed unimportant because nobody was eating it. And chicken are much easier to grow than swine or beef. And they can grow in backyards. And so chicken became a very, very big industry to the point now where we have over 9 billion broiler chickens that are produced in the United States, mostly for domestic consumption every year. We also produce 285 million eggs per day in the United States. Beef consumption has flattened. It's still very important to us as a culture, but is really flattened over the past 4 years. But we still consume about 60 pounds of beef per person per year. 2010 information, U.S. government information, 30 pounds of eggs, 45 pounds of pork, 60 pounds each of beef and chicken. Actually, chicken's a little bit higher than that. Remarkably to me, because I love fish, fish doesn't even make it to that list. We now consume about 15 pounds of fish per person, and more than half of that in the United States is aquaculture, which explains why 91% of the seafood that we eat is imported from outside the United States. We don't eat that much of it, and what we do eat is farmed, and since farming in the United States for fish is like 5% of our total fish production or landings, most of it is coming from overseas in the form of whitefish of one form or another, or as we like to call it at our company, tofu of the sea.
Dick.
I know I'm not supposed to ask questions, I'm supposed to give answers, but my wife watches The Chew and Rachel Ray, and so our diet consists of what was on television that day, and never have we had an American public so conscious of what they ate because of these television shows. So I applaud that. And my question to you, about 2 months ago we had a cook-off, and we had Atlantic salmon that had been aquaculture and raw catch Atlantic salmon. And so I walked in there and says, look how dark a red this is. This has got to be the wild. Not true. The domestic or aquaculture had been fed beta carotene to darken the meat or some other pigment. I'm not sure what that was. And I'm not very culinarily skilled, but it tasted the same to me when we looked at it. I have a friend who is a biotechnologist, and he wants to release into aquaculture a GMO Atlantic salmon that has a phenomenal growth rate. And so I would bounce that out there. Are you guys prepared to eat a GMO product from aquaculture? And are aquaculture artificially, that's a bad term, are there feed ingredients given to our aquaculture animals to improve their palatability?
Yeah, we can both comment on this. Just a basic fact. So when you eat a farmed salmon, right, you're eating a fish that's fed fish. You're eating a carnivorous fish. Farmed salmon that we eat in the United States are farmed in Chile and in Norway and a little bit on the in Canada. Typically, the fish farmer is catching wild fish, grinding them up into little pellets that look like dog food but taste like fish, and feeding them to the farmed salmon in these big ocean pens. And in the process, converting at a minimum 4 pounds of wild fish into 1 pound of farm fish, at a minimum. So, you know, you think you're doing something good for the wild fishery by eating a farmed creature. It's not true if you're eating a fish that eats fish, okay? So now that it's in the interest, as you just said, it's in the business interest of the fish farmers to reduce that conversion ratio because they have to pay for the wild food stock that they feed to their fish. It's also in the interest of conserving the oceans for that to happen. So people are working on it. And they've been bringing down the conversion ratio over time by mixing in more and more vegetable protein in with the wild protein. As you do that, the fish becomes more and less tasty, shall we say. And in fact, it becomes more gray. And the only reason that any farmed fish that you have eaten as an American has anything other than an entirely gray color is because it is dyed. And the fish meat is dyed through dye that's in the pellets. And in fact, we had at Oceana at one point, you know when you go to like Sherwin-Williams and you decide you want to repaint your bedroom, they'll give you a color wheel and you can say, I want the Lubbock Sienna Sunrise, you know, or whatever it is. The fish feed providers do the same for the aquaculturists and they let them patent, you know, red number 6, Pantene number 4. And so that wonderful color that you saw was actually an intentionally chosen color by the farmer based on the dye. Now, you ask a really smart question. The way they're ultimately going to get the conversion ratio down without having the fish be disgusting to eat is with some kind of genetic modification. And that is going to present a dilemma for the likes of us. And we have, at Oceana, haven't wrestled with it in a way that I can say to you that my board of directors, which is a smart group of people, knows exactly what it thinks about that. I'll tell you what I think about it. I think there's a huge problem with escapes in this fishery. And in fact, we think it's such a huge problem that we like to call it releases, because we think that a lot of the fish farmers watch the price of the fish and, you know, they can do an insurance opportunity. They can place an insurance claim if the price drops. And so we don't think it's always an escape. But there also are these problems with, like, sea lions coming by the fish pens and ripping them open because it's like a giant smorgasbord and letting fish escape. So genetically modified escapes of, you know, large numbers of farmed fish into the ocean would be very troubling to us. And the genetic modifiers will assert that they're going to be sterile and that they don't have any way of reproducing, and most of the time that'll be true, but it won't take many for that not to be true for you to have a big problem. So starting where we are, we're going to say the better answer is to farm fish that don't eat fish, tilapia, carp, or even better, to farm shellfish. Because a shellfish farmer is a customer who's promoting a good environmental outcome. They're filter feeders, they need a healthy ocean, and they don't migrate, they don't escape.
Helene and Chris, either one of you want to take a crack at the GMO question? We don't want to spend the rest of our time on this, but there is certainly one of the something in the suite of solutions.
Well, I guess I can't speak, you know, specifically to the GMO question, but I think I can talk a little bit about the difference in complexity between, you know, say a farm on the land and an ecosystem in the ocean from my background in food security. You know, if you have a farm and you abuse it, you know, you have this kind of linear progression of land degradation, and it gets worse and worse and worse, but it doesn't die. You know, if you're looking at a coral reef and you abuse that coral reef, or it gets too hot, or you overfish it, it's gone. And so, I can't speak to specifics about GMOs, but the ocean is complex, and I think that suggests caution.
I'd just like to say that I think there are many different approaches to how we're going to feed the world, and a lot of things are in the experimentation phase. And I think many of them deserve a chance. But I would not be betting on those efforts that have real likely potential to overrun an existing healthy ecosystem or an ecosystem that needs to be revived. And I put GMO salmon in oceans in that category. I think there are some more promising possibilities with salmon, with algae feeding that is happening in the southern tip of Chile. Although I have to tell you, it doesn't taste very good. I have tasted it. It tastes like algae. And I don't know about you, but that's not what I like food, and algae doesn't fit into that framework either. But there's also some land-based approach to aquaculture that high, you know, global warming potential in just the construction. But if they really are used over time and the water is managed well and the effluents are managed, and if you've got more than one species in that integrated multi-trophic system, I think there really are some potentials for looking at raising fish differently in aquaculture than we've had. And that particular example, you may not have had, you may have had late season lowest level species of Alaskan salmon. There are four major species, and they range in colors too, and tastes and so forth. So try again. Okay. Sounds good. Yeah.
Dick, let's talk a little bit about GMOs and some of the interesting things that are out there that are potentially innovative solutions.
I'd like to start that comment by talking about the global population that was mentioned earlier. Today, we're at 7.1 The estimate varies when we'll level off, if we'll level off, but by 2050, and thank God this is not my problem, it will be my children's and my grandchildren's problems, we're estimating 9.1, 9.2 million people unless some pandemic disaster happens. And to feed that many people, any type of diet at all, is complicated because India and China are quickly becoming rising powers. And as they do, they demand more calories. They demand more calories in meat products and dairy products and eggs, just like you mentioned. And so not only are we faced with a finite planet that we've messed up pretty good, I would agree with that. And so we got to produce more food, better quality food. And I'm here to tell you that we're not going to do that unless we're prepared to use GMOs. And I visited with Christy yesterday. All GMOs are not created equal. And there's technology out there today where you can silence genes. One of the crops I work with is castor. And if we're talking about green chemicals, superior lubrications, advanced polymers, castor oil is where it's at. And you probably remember castor oil in a different light when it's used in a medicinal purpose. Somewhat disgusting, but still used. And so castor also produces a product called ricin. And me and the FBI and Homeland Security talk about it about every 3 months when some white powder shows up in an envelope at a post office. That gene, and I've been trying to silence since 1994, is really tough to work with when you're a conventional plant breeder and want a non-GMO. There is technology out there where they could take the gene and turn it around and reinsert it with a promoter and completely silence ricin and castor. I don't know how many millions of dollars it would save in the FBI and the CIA and Homeland Security, but then I could take the meal left off of castor and feed it to cattle and make a whole different cascading feed situation like you're talking about and remove a product that no one's really standing around waiting for. And so I would like our science community to come together, and I would like our science community to say not all transgenes are created the same and not all transgenes require the same level of testing. And in Atlantic salmon, I agree. Let's go for the $80 million version. And silence a gene like ricin and castor, let's go for the $10 million version, okay? Because it's already a gene, it's already in the plant, we're just flipping the switch and turning it off. And losing a product out of an organism instead of adding a product represents a whole different thing of risk. One other last thing I'd say, as we look toward a planet with 9+ billion people on it, we need to get us some theology types and some ecology types and lock them in a room until they can address the problem. 9.2, if not at the carrying capacity this planet is approaching it, until we have our religious leaders agree, okay, to educate women and men, mostly women, about the birth control options they have and still remain within the covenants of their religion. And this is a lot of religions. I'm not just picking on one here. We are fighting a losing battle.
Chris, you want to jump on the gender issue?
Sure, yeah, it's really great to bring that point up. And, you know, and I think it's worth remembering that 9-point-something number, you know, for 2050, that's the United Nations, you know, medium estimate. And if you go and you look around the world today at a lot of places, Niger or Ethiopia or India, you know, I mean, you see a lot of places where that demographic transition, you know, that whole estimate is kind of based on this European model of a transition to fewer kids. And, you know, we could end up at 11 as opposed to 9 or maybe 10. So it's a big, big concern. And, you know, I think a lot of times when we think about the food crisis, you know, we think about increasing production. And I think that reducing consumption is a really important part of it, and obviously a key part of that is lowering growth rates. And so I think that there's a lot of things that we could do to empower women and to educate women. By the way, a United Nations report just came out last month, and we have reached global parity in women's education. So, I mean, this is a place where we're already seeing huge advances. But I think we need to keep pushing on this, and it's really going to be, we could end up at, you know, 10 billion, or we could end up at, you know, 8 billion, and I think it's really within our purview to try to pursue that.
And women are important because?
Well, I'm married to one, and the good thing about educating and empowering women is it has all kinds of knock-on effects. I mean, for example, we just did a study, two different studies on malnutrition in Mali and Kenya, looking at climate impacts on childhood stunting, which we found. But by far the most important predictor of the health of your child, whether they're stunted, which is a tragic thing, is women's education. And so this is a thing that just has all kinds of important consequences.
Helene, let's talk about meat as a garnish and other innovative ways to go to address some of these issues.
I think the most important thing is that when we try to educate consumers broadly, it's very expensive, it's a shot in the dark, and consumers often come up somewhat confused about the message. Why? Because only those who are really interested in these issues deeply are going to look beyond the surface. The other thing that's of concern to me is that the food industry, and by that I really mean the large-scale manufacturers, throw so much more money behind advertising than NGOs and other, well-interested, well-intended folks, us as a company, can use in trying to get a message across. That's very, very diluted in terms of what the consumers can understand. And I'll give the example of what kind of fish people can should eat. What is sustainable seafood? I went on a tour in 2005 to 35 of our colleges and we even had a nice video and we had a discussion afterwards, and I can't tell you how many times then and since then I have heard from people who say, I only eat farmed fish because, we have a terrible overfishing problem. Or I only eat wild fish because there's terrible problems with aquaculture. The nuances aren't getting through. So what we've chosen to do is use our chefs as choice editors and say, well, we have 500 of them and we employ them, and we serve 135 million meals a year to countless numbers of consumers. So I have a monthly webcast to our chefs. Big picture, I used to be a theater director, by the way. Can you tell by the ways I use my hands? And I know that you can't tell an actor how to act. You have to tell an actor what you want out of him or her in that final performance. Chefs are exactly the same way. If they have the freedom to choose what they're going to put on their menus, you tell them where you need to get them to go. And so we give them tools, we give them information, then we monitor what they purchase. And for the 5% who either didn't get it or wasn't able to listen to the webcast or didn't read any of the emails, then we call them up and coach them. But it's a method of persuading those 500 that they have the power, the responsibility, and the sort of the sacred effort to make the change on behalf of their guests. So to truly answer your question, three things: we have reduced the plate sizes in as many restaurants as we have the opportunity to do that. Because guests are interested in filling their plates more than they are in choosing a certain quantity of food. They feel satisfied, and that's based on very good food lab research out of University of Illinois and out of Cornell. We've reduced the size of the scoopers on a line so that the generous Mary or Bessie who is out of college and thinks that the young woman or man on the other side of the line is too skinny, isn't going to automatically put that much more food on the student's plate. And then we've also rearranged salad bars and other stations so that the greens and the whole grains are put on the plate first. So the meat at the end is put on as a garnish top. And it makes a really, and we do that on buffet lines too, and it makes a really big difference in the quantity of meats that people take.
Very sneaky and smart.
It is sneaky.
I want to encourage SEJ members and working journalists, if you have questions, start lining up, because we want to save time for questions. And I will come to you when I start seeing you at the mics. Andy, when we think about aquaculture, farming the oceans, and getting food from the oceans, I know I first think of ocean acidification from climate change. And, you know, is the ocean even going to be a hospitable place to do some of this innovative farming?
Yeah, I hate this question. I want to be an optimist about the future, and I am optimistic about our ability to manage the oceans' problems of overfishing. They come down to doing three things: quotas, habitat, and bycatch. And we can set up sensible aquaculture farms, well-run, well-managed. We can do that. But the problem of ocean acidification is a kind of a trump card on all of that. I assume everybody here knows what it is, but just to briefly introduce it, carbon dioxide that is emitted to the air is absorbed by the ocean. So the CO2 changes in the atmosphere generate chemistry changes in the ocean. They drive the ocean in a more acidic direction. About a third of the CO2 that goes into the atmosphere goes into the ocean through a natural absorption process. That has already had impacts that are measurable, as you just said, on creatures that make their shells out of calcium. Calcium gets eaten away by a more acidic ocean, and it's easy to picture creatures in the ocean that have shells, for example. Reefs are threatened by acidic water. The move that the oceans are already underway is dramatic by geological time. Many of the solutions that the world contemplates in an extremis for climate change don't reduce the CO2 in the atmosphere. They, you know, you do things to, you know, in the boldest vision of a disastrous future, we shade the ocean. Well, that doesn't change the CO2 in the atmosphere. You know, we do cloud covery things. That doesn't change the CO2 in the atmosphere. So acidification remains as an underlying event that could be quite damaging for the oceans. So I hate this question. Don't have a good answer for it, except that all of the things that the planet, the good people of the planet are doing to reduce CO2 emissions have another really important benefit, which is to save the oceans from this potentially cataclysmic event. I don't see right now that the world is moving very quickly on that path. So, but I got to believe that it will get there, just because otherwise this really is a disastrous thing. I think we probably have a little more time on the acidification issue than, you know, we have time to do it. So we have more time on that actually than we do on the overfishing problems, which are more acute but more fixable.
If I can just follow, you are, though, optimistic. All things considered, you would like to be optimistic about the ocean as being able to provide more food.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like I'm now like, you know, being given a personality test, which in some extent I am. But yes, I'm optimistic. Here's why I like working on the oceans. And, you know, you're a smart audience, so you led with the toughest question, Christy. But I mean, ocean fisheries rebound very fast. Ocean fish are incredibly prolific. They lay eggs by the millions. We can tell you stories and show data of fish that had been mismanaged and collapsed. If you do three things, quotas, habitat, and bycatch, in 5 or 10 years, you see abundance in the water. It's not like waiting 100 years for the rainforest to grow back. This is a very fixable climate, a conservation problem and food benefiting area of the ocean, except for acidification. So I'm optimistic. I think we have time to fix acidification. I think the planet cares enough about the drivers that are driving acidification. Like if we lose Florida, if we lose Manhattan, we will get people's attention. And so I think people would probably be willing to lose the reefs of the world more than they would be willing to lose Florida. But the task of saving Florida will probably end up saving the reefs. That's what I hope.
Great. That's optimism. Thank you. we have one questioner, which is great. I want to go to you first, and I have a couple more questions for the panel. So could you introduce yourself? Oh, great. Can you introduce yourself, please, and ask your question? And no speeches, please.
Okay, yes. I'm Larry Pryor. I'm at the Annenberg School for Communication at USC. And being from Los Angeles, we're quite aware of a disastrous situation in our high schools where there is a program to encourage young people to eat healthy foods, and it is more or less being forced on them, and they are rejecting it. Much of the food, or not say much, but a good percentage of the food is being wasted. The kids are going out on the street and going across the street to get unhealthy foods. And I'm just wondering, particularly Helene, you're addressing college audiences, but what are we going to do about the high school children? And a second part of that question would be, is there any possibility of using high schools and middle schools to encourage children to eat farmed fish?
Great. Helene?
I'm actually pretty optimistic about the upcoming generation, and not because there are a lot of activists, but because I think the situation in Los Angeles was really a result of lack of looking at all the cultural aspects of food, which is so important. Food is culture in so many ways. You can't just wholesale change a diet and say, this is better for you, and expect anybody to accept that. It has to be gradual. It has to be part of, isn't this yummy, and trying it out. You will get food waste in the beginning before you get acceptance. But it can't be a radical wholesale change with a lot of politics attached to it, with a lot of parents saying, see, I told you so, and expect that it'll be successful. There are more campus gardens that I would have ever dreamed to be existing right now. We actually just launched yesterday a campus garden program nationally. It is happening at the college level, but frankly, it's happening at lower levels too, in high schools, in elementary schools. My son was in a preschool where, you know, the kids were only grew carrots and peas, but they loved those carrots and peas because it was their carrots and peas. And I think that's a big part of it. In Los Angeles, they didn't do that. It was all, this is healthy for you, as opposed to, this is what I grew and I'm proud of it. And you need to start much more slowly. And I think that's happening. Good or bad, local foods, you know, I mean, there are all kinds of issues. But I think we really need to say we need to reintroduce young people to vegetables and to really make that part of their life for them to see possibilities other than I'm Doritos is my yellow food for the day.
Anybody else want to jump in? Or
this is a... I know your question was kind of very practical, like we have kids in Los Angeles and we want to change their diets in the next 2 years, and I respect that. Again, a source of optimism, however, is if you step back a little further and you take a little longer time frame view, there's astounding changes in people's diets and appetites and attitudes toward food. I mean, just incredible. One story. In colonial Massachusetts, there were laws forbidding masters from serving their indentured servants lobster more than 3 times a week. Now, that's, you know, a couple hundred, 300 years ago, but that's a fairly dramatic change in the attitude we have toward lobster. Crabs, where I come from, Chesapeake Bay, were fed to prisoners. And they were fertilizer. They're now $45 a bushel. You know, very high-end meat, fish, seafood. On and on. In the seafood zone, we see this over and over and over again, where a fish that was a low-status item becomes a high-status item. Salmon used to be basically dog food. It was not considered a tasty thing, and is now loved, of course. So you can see in that flexibility some optimism.
Yeah, and those fish usually get renamed as part of that process so that you don't know that you're...
Can I make a quick comment on
sure.
that? It seems like on the Internet that about every week floats up another rumor. The reason we have obesity in the U.S. is because of beta-alanine, or the reason we have obesity in the U.S. is because of some other nutrient. And is there any group out there that's really addressing that? Because it seems like any website can condemn or blame any other commodity for America's obesity other than just overeating. So that's kind of a leads to, you know, is better diet doing it, or do we actually have a dietary problem?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't have a solution to this, but I think we have to recognize that a part of the problem of, you know, obesity in children and, you know, having children with poor eating habits, it really does relate to, you know, at least in part, to issues of poverty, right? And it is really cheap to go and get all these processed foods, which so children, you know, grew up eating that. And, you know, so I think that there's a lot of advances, but I'm concerned that those are often really split. You know, so where I live in Santa Barbara, California, it's almost like two cities. You know, there are schools, public schools that are like the best in San Francisco. There are public schools that are as bad as the baddest in Watts. And I bet if you looked at what was eaten in those two schools, you know, so, you know, I guess part of the question is how do we bring vegetables to everybody in an affordable way is a good question.
Yeah, particularly tasty vegetables. Identify yourself, please.
Ann Payne, formerly with the Tennessean in Nashville, Tennessee. I want to ask y'all about any efforts you know of to take advantage of things, the exotic species that sort of go hog wild, like the Asian carp here, our species that go wild overseas, maybe the gray squirrels in England, whatever. But what's happening with that? Any way we can make that part of our nutritious diet?
Kudzu, Nutria?
Let me address that as best I can. I'm worried about GMOs, not so much because we're a huge experiment. There's 300 plus million of us that are going through the living laboratory to see what the 30-year effects of GMOs are, okay? And I'm not too worried about that. But I am worried about GMOs concentrating primarily on four or maybe five crop species. And we do a survey among our colleagues and say, how many of you working on corn, or how many are you looking on wheat, or how many of you working on broad beans or vegetables? And the plant improvement community has dwindled so that 90% of them are working on four species. So when I train a plant breeder, I tell them, when you go home, your job's not done. Everybody has to take a minor crop and breed it at home because there's nobody doing it. And globally, the community, as resources become less and governments cut back, and we've cut back, oh, so many species. I was telling Christy yesterday that three crop species occupy 73% of the land in the U.S., corn, wheat, and soybeans. And so you look at the acreage of barley, you look at the acreage of oats, you look at the acreage of the other crops, have given up those acres. And so the seed companies are just moving to the profit zone. They say, I've got a 100 million acre corn market, I've got an 80 million acre soybean market, I've got a 60 plus million acre wheat market, and I will recover my cost of research. And so I worry about the loss of biodiversity as we go forward. I get criticized a little bit because if it isn't dangerous or hasn't killed somebody, I won't work on it, okay? Because I believe that the wilder it is, the meaner it is, the tougher it is, we got to harness it and put it in behind the wagon.
And Dick, let me just stay with you for a second and just, you know, what we've been going through this last summer in the Midwest with corn is a little bit of a wake-up call, don't you think, about what a lot of the world is going through?
Here's what worries me, even with the forecasting we have. What if a disease came in and took our soybean crop? Just one disease, and it's happened before. And it's happened in our country, and it happened to corn, okay? What if one of those three workhorses we have out there, a new wheat rust, a new disease on corn that no one anticipated, and we have to divert crops? We have to do the improvement. We have to get the seed stocks up. In a really real way, we have to retrain our farmers how to grow another crop. And so it's scary out there to see so much of U.S. agriculture has become so monotrophic and concentrate on those. You can't blame the seed companies. It's a corporate business, and they've got to move to the profit center. But it worries me as a plant breeder, who's developing the spinach of the future? Who's developing alfalfa sprouts? Or who's developing these commodities that we need for the balanced nutrition in our country and certainly abroad, where we need to grow crops for what's going to be a very hungry third world?
Anybody else on?
Yeah, I guess I would speak to this. I think that that's one of my biggest concerns. You know, if you think about the way that we might be able to succeed in the short term and fail in the long term through maladaption. You know, let's say that we came up with some, you know, magic bullet way of doubling corn yields so that we all of a sudden had this breathing room. And then at the same time, we didn't diversify our food economy. We didn't diversify how we, you know, access food through all these kind of farming kind of ways. And then after our population goes up and the whole stress system gets bigger, we get, you know, H5N1 coming and wiping out the corn crop. So, I mean, I think there's a real need to respond through diversification as opposed to just trying to eke out more productivity from our existing system.
Yes.
I mean, I love this way of ending up if we're going to end up here. Agriculture, in its most efficient form, is an aggressively anti-biodiverse activity. Aggressively. Mm-hmm. We go ever, ever, ever closer, as you very vividly just described, to the most efficient thing. The wonderful thing about the ocean, where you're harvesting a wild resource, is that if you're sensible, you're not simplifying that system. If you're sensible just from a food production perspective, you're not simplifying the natural system of the ocean. You're protecting all of the fish in there because that will give you the diversity that keeps you abundant. Now, I was once challenged on this. Somebody said, well, wait a minute. If you want to feed as much people as you can, as many people as you can from a wild ocean, you ought to get rid of all the top trophic animals in the ocean because they eat a lot of fish that we could be eating. So let's machine gun all the sea lions because they eat up like 1,000 pounds of fish a day. And that'll be good if you're interested in feeding people. And I said, you know, you're right about that. You know, and then let's do that. Let's eliminate trophic level 5. And we'll eat all those fish. Now, let's think about the logic of your point. The logic of your point is that now there's a new top level in the ocean. That'll be called trophic level 4. They look like they're eating an unfair share. Let's get rid of them, too. Now there's a new trophic level. It's 3. Let's get rid of them. Let's get rid of 2. Pretty soon, you have to decide you like eating bacteria or algae because the logic drives you all the way down to the bottom. And then you're in the situation you just described, where one parasite, one blight, you can have an Irish potato blight of the oceans. So there is this inherent tension in the way we run things, but if you take an even middle-run view of the terrestrial system or the ocean system, from a food production perspective, you need the biodiversity to protect you against the changes that are coming with climate change especially.
Would you identify yourself and ask your question?
Yes, I'm Carrie Koplinka-Lair. I direct the Northeastern Integrated Pest Management Center at Cornell University. And I have a question primarily for Helene, but perhaps for the rest of you. Pests are a huge threat to the security of our food supply. And we've developed a certain number of methods for curbing pests, some of which have environmental consequences. I'm interested in hearing, particularly from Helene, about some of the choices that have occurred at Bon Appetit for choosing food that is sustainably grown on land particularly, and some of the trade-offs you've needed to make. And I guess I'm thinking about organic food and also food that might carry an IPM label but might not exactly say that.
We don't have a unit that's able to identify or to verify claims made by producers. We're just talking crops now. But of course, in food service, there's food that comes in cans too, right? So you have tomatoes that have come in a can. We don't have much of that, but we definitely have a lot of canned tomatoes. We have a program underway to favor tomatoes in particular that are grown IPM, not organic. And we do that for a couple of reasons. One, we buy more tomatoes than anything else. Onions will be the second thing that we work on because that's the number two thing that we buy. The other is that we feel that, we can't increase prices. These are board costs for colleges. And so we can't go from, to have all organic. We think that a better role for us to play is to try to generate change. So if we work with farmers to get them to move toward IPM with extension services or others who know a lot more about this than we do, and they go on a path toward reducing their pesticide or their chemical herbicide use, then we've done something that others can't do. I mean, individual consumers can't do that quite the way a company that buys $350 million worth of food a year can do. So we tend to look for opportunities where our larger buying power can change the supply chain in a better direction rather than buying the cream of the crop. Not to say we don't buy organics, we just don't buy that much of it.
I want to end with a sort of a final question and a kind of rapid-fire answer because we've only got about 2 minutes left. And I want to start with Dick. And just the issue, really, of ethics and morality in food. We're a very rich nation. The rest of the world isn't so well off, or a lot of it isn't so well off. If you could just speak very briefly about food morality.
Yes, and this is something I have discussed and will continue to discuss in my class. I stand here before you almost obese. And how is that fair when the people died across the globe from malnutrition? And those people died across the globe from malnutrition, and some in our country too, are mostly under 2 years old. Okay? And so there comes a basic ethic question. I don't care what religion you base it on. Why is that fair? And globally, if we want political stability, we have to at least, in our own conscience, approach a way that we're helping feed the hungry in the world. That said, I've about given up on Africa. It just makes me tired to think about how we're going to train those people and reduce their birth rate and how we're going to bring technology to them. I read the other day the Somalian pilots are back fishing instead of stealing cars. No, they were stealing boats, that's right. Some of the boats had cars. So, when you look at the huge challenge, it's going to take someone with spirit and innovation and almost a mystical quality to them to lead us to solve this problem. And Norman Barlog started a good approach years and years ago, and I don't see that leadership out there. I know it's not me.
Thank you. Chris.
I'd like to follow up with that question and or that statement and say that, you know, there's really a lot of hope for Africa. And, you know, the problem is that their yields are about 1/7 of what they are in the United States. But you can turn that on its head and realize that is a great opportunity. And there are a lot of, this is kind of new, but over, like, say, the last 8 years, there's been a lot of movement towards building agricultural development and capacity in Africa. And there's, you know, it's slow to happen. But with the proper governance and the proper support from countries like the United States, you know, those yields could be tripled or quadrupled. And that would both really help people in Africa, but it would also really help, you know, ease the global pressure on the food.
Helene?
Two quick things. From my perspective, signaling change through the supply chain, and the more people in corporate life who do that, I think we have the potential of really igniting a lot more change to the better. Things like integrated pest management, things like reduced antibiotics in meat production, I think is critically important for human medicine efficacy. And the other thing I think is, we haven't really talked about today, but You know, 40% of the edible food in the United States goes to waste. And very little of that goes to compost. I mean, even if it does, you've still lost so much of the energy that was used to produce it, to get it to you, to prepare it, and so forth. But I have a huge ethical problem with that. I mean, you know, we've all been taught as little kids, eat everything on your plate. There are starving kids in India. And when you're about the age of 7, you say, well, how is that going to get to India? But it's so much bigger than that. And it's about choosing less. It's about being responsible for the food, whether you're a meeting planner planning a buffet or if you're trying to serve 135 million meals a year.
Andy, you get the last word.
Yeah, I want to make concrete where I think this very abstract question could be in my world. And we've talked about it already. I think in the next 5 or 10 years, it will be important to know what, I mean, you will have to have a point of view, and the world will start to take a point of view on whether it's okay to feed fish to animals. Because there's a market that says that's logical, and you can convert the anchovies in Peru into a farmed salmon and sell it to the north. And if you follow the market logic, that will continue to be the case for the foreseeable future. If you ask an ethical question, though, and you say, as an ethical matter, I'm going to put some limits on what the market wants to do. I'm going to refuse to allow the market to do some things it will do. That's what ethics is. Then you could say, it is time now for the world that is hungry to take those anchovies and feed them to people, because if it will do that, 400 million people will eat fish that won't otherwise eat healthy animal protein. That's an ethical opportunity. I think that's in front of us now, and I think that will get answered in realistic ways over the coming 5 or 10 years by leading NGOs and leading policymakers around the world. I don't think it's going to get done. I think it's going to be a battle between the market forces and the ethical forces. But I think the battle is about to be joined there. And I think the stakes are on the order of what I said. 300 or 400 million people a day forever could be eating seafood that are instead of pigs and cows.
Great. I want to thank this wonderful panel. And please give them a round of applause and maybe a yee-haw.